You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to Filmmaking Conversations with Damian Swabey. Listen to conversations with award-winning filmmakers, directors from the golden age of television, and creatives from the indie film community who continue to inspire the next generation of filmmakers. And now, over to your host, Damian Swabey.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Filmmaking Conversations with me, Damian Swabey. Today on the podcast, I speak to producer Jack Clark and Brett Gregory, the writer-director of the brilliant British feature film Nobody Loves You and You Don't Deserve to Exist. We discuss this film and life for filmmakers in the UK who are working class and may be living and working outside of the UK industry. All of this and more on Filmmaking Conversations with Damian Swabey.
Brett. Gregory. Hello, Brett. How you doing?
I'm doing all right. How you doing, Damian?
I'm doing fine. Always good to speak to passionate people in film. I really like that. Passionate people like yourself and Jack Clark. So who's on the podcast with us right now? So great days ahead of us, I think. I really do.
Well, yeah, it's the New Year's Eve, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
There we go. 2023.
Great drinks we'll be having tonight, I hope. Brett, tell us a bit about yourself, as if we've just met in the pub and we're having a few pints. Jack's come, sat right next to us, and he's going to tell us about himself afterwards.
We'll just start with the pub. Right. Who's got my wallet? It must be one of you. Who put this song on? Again, this is rubbish. Right. Anyway, what would I say? So, yeah, I'm sort of 51 now. I don't know how you say that. It sounds like a Tinder date. So, yeah, my background is in academia. I'm sort of, in a former life, used to be a lecturer in film, media and cultural studies. So throughout the 2000s and before that, I was a sort of, you know, obviously at university and a master's student in literature and with bits of film. So I've come into film from an academic and theoretical perspective, as well as a creative one, but I'm not formally, you know, I didn't go to film school or anything. I'm not formally or technically trained or anything like that.
I see. But what about yourself, Jack?
So I'm a co-producer, mainly aspiring producer, worked with Brett. Brett taught, I think it was all the way back in 2019 now, whilst I was doing media production at Salford University. He had a project going, which was the feature film project that I've been involved in closely for about 3 years now. And for somebody like me, from my background, it was sort of like the most interesting, most exciting thing going. And then I sort of started on one shoot doing boom operating, and then did that for a couple of shoots, as well as just being a general assistant. And now sort of 3-4 years in, we're getting coverage in the Morning Star. I had an MEN interview just the other day that was published. And it's great to be involved in film and actual films that mean something. And that's sort of my goal as co-producer and a creative practitioner. It's actually a serious feather, really.
Excellent. And I like when you said films that mean something. I really do. Because we see so many films nowadays, in my opinion, that don't mean anything.
They're rubbish. Most films are rubbish. They're rubbish. There's loads of films that are rubbish. Most films are rubbish. Anyway, but then
as sorry, long as you're prepared to tell us how you feel, Brett, I can
well, should have been warned before I next one.
And so, Jack, when you mentioned your background, I kind of can guess what you mean, but for some of the listeners who wouldn't understand, and some of the listeners are not based in the UK, what exactly do you mean?
Yeah, so I mean, to put it pretty straight, a working class lad from pretty rough, but I'm downplaying it a lot, from an estate, Kersal in Salford. And I mean, even being involved in anything film and media related seems impossible for not just myself, but many people from this background, especially at this age, because there's a lot of nepotism and cronyism and just basically gatekeeping to basically say, well, if you're not in the cult, like Eyes Wide Shut or something, then you're not getting in at all. You're just not accessible. So what working with Brett and what this film has done is giving me an accessible opportunity to be actually a part of something as a working class practitioner. And I hope to, in turn, with the publicity it's getting at the moment and the attention it's getting around the world, not just for myself, but for the UK in general, is to inspire other working class creatives to say, well, look, just because, you know, because a lot of time your own family can put you down as well from that background, because you go, oh, there's no money to be made there. What are you doing that for? You're just a dreamer.
They can be the biggest people. Some of them can be the biggest.
Yeah. Well, I mean, my own family don't even believe them. I've even made a feature film. They still don't even believe it now. And I've been in Manchester. they just think I'm sat in my bedroom just out and I'm flicking bogeys at the wall or something all day. So, but yeah, I do hope that being involved in this as somebody my age can serve as a role model, really, to say, well, look, you don't have to go down a fixed path. You can do things for yourself creatively and be in part of it. You don't have to go a set path. You don't have to have approval even to get an industry. If you get around the right people, build yourself a crew and have the right ideas that are tangible, then you can just do it yourself. And that's what I think I'd encourage others to do my age. Just go out and do it yourself. Don't wait for somebody to approve you, because they're not going to do it.
I love that. And I believe the exact same thing. If you have a story to tell, if you're passionate, if you are able to do it, just go and do it. I think I'm quoting Mark Duplass when he said, the cavalry isn't coming. Mm-hmm. So you've got to go out and just make your film.
There is no God. You're on your own.
You're on your own. So the film itself, tell us about that. What is it about?
It's semi-autobiographical. I think there's many reasons for why films are made or stories are told. But I was in a situation, because the film's been taken 7 years to get here. So the film took 6.5 years to make, you know. Because in another life, my best friend, who is also my previous cinematographer, he died of sudden adult death syndrome. So he died at 26.
Sorry to hear that.
And then there was just this succession of sort of, not caused by that, but it just felt like it, where then I was already estranged from my family. I had two families, one in the north of England, one in the south of England. And they weren't really bothered, so that we've sort of, there we go, cut ties sort of thing. And then because of the, I don't know, corrupt banking crisis in
2008,
but then I was obviously as a lecturer in film and cultural studies. And then, yeah, I was made redundant like a year after all this other stuff had happened. And so it hit the education sector. And there you go. So in the space of a year, everything had been, my girlfriend left me, which is very good for, really good for creative. Well, yeah, that's it. It's like, you know, if you're not singing the right songs, they go. And so everything, it just, there you go. It was like this personal cataclysmic-ish thing. And it felt, you know, and everything, the foundations of whatever, it was sort of taken away, you know, and we're just gone. And there was no one to talk to about it. And so the thing is obviously, you know, I wasn't the best, but I just came down to where you assess, which happens to everybody, I think, at some point in your life, where you assess what you are, what are you? And not necessarily in, you know, practical terms, I'm going on what is, and obviously say, why has this happened and stuff, I suppose, even though that's pointless. And then from that, I went and started writing a script, and I just started to write, not like a diary, because I can't write, I don't have to keep a diary, but it was like, oh, if this was a film, how would it be?
You know? I see.
And how would it, but I didn't really think about an audience. I just think, this is what I'd say to anybody listening, you should make a film that matters to you, and I mean really matters to you. So the fact is, and that's how this film ended up getting crewed up and casted, because everybody knew that this film was about real life, something that really happens, do you know what I mean? And again, and then and that's why none of them, well, I'm sure they wanted paying, but they weren't going to get paid. They had no money. But yeah, so in terms of writing the script, we did the first version of the script, and then, but then I met up through LinkedIn when I was looking for teaching jobs, met with Gwyn Hemmings, and who was an assistant to Nick, who's previous cinematographer. And but he carried on working in, you know, sort of freelance industry. And then we met up and, you know, I went through the project and the script and he went, I want to do this. This is, you know, there's nothing like this to be done. And I went, I know. And yeah, and there you go. So then you've got one person and he's got equipment, you know, and he's, that's it. He's got camera and lighting and stuff like that. And then, but there's the validation of him then saying, this is something I want to do. And then slowly, and then we started filming because I'm hot on, I like dream sequences or nightmare sequences. So I said, well, that's the easiest thing to film it to start with. So, you know, there's no people in it. So we can film this and sort of see how it looks. And then as soon as I see footage and edit footage, then it gives you different ideas and you want to change things, you know what I mean? And so then from that, and this was like 2016, and I said, Gwyn, I've got to rewrite the whole script.
Nice one.
It's going to probably take me another 10 months. And he went, right, okay, I'll wait. And there you go. And so, I mean, so it took about 2 years, 2.5 years to do the script. It was just through a process, but it came, I mean, for a personally distressing source, but then, like, creatively, it came from a very pure source. There was nothing to do with this film's going to make money and loads of people going to watch this film or anything like that. It was about, well, I've said it before, like a Wilhelm scream, you know, some sort of announcement that you're still alive, you know?
I see.
And heavy, I told you.
Heavy. So yeah, are you from a working class background as well?
Well, yeah, I suppose this is his connection with Jack. The thing is it's similar sort of trajectories because I grew up on a council estate in the, you know, in the 70s, 80s in Nottinghamshire, and which was really rough. And it was about the time of the miners' strike for all those history buffs. And so there was, and then after that, there was all these jobs lost. There was a lot of violence and crime and abuse and drugs and stuff through these sort of council estates. And the only escape was education. So I had to, and I sort of knuckled down and did my A-levels. And obviously alienated everyone on the estate because you didn't do that. You meant to get girls pregnant and just move in together. That's what you meant to do. So I didn't. I did my A-levels and then got into uni. And that was it. And everyone's there saying, well, that's a waste of time. You're never going to make any money, which is true. And I just did I did literature and film and creative writing for us as a degree because I enjoyed it and I wanted to know more. There you go. And anyway, sorry.
No, because I was just thinking earlier to what Jack said about how hard it is for filmmakers in the UK from a working class background to move into making feature films or any kind of television content. Why do you both think that is the case? There's this glass ceiling that doesn't seem like it's going to change much soon.
Because, like Jack mentioned, in terms of nepotism or the fact of familiarity, middle-class people like other middle-class people and want to work with them. Working-class, I mean, there is a different value system. You know, there is a middle-class people tend to have a parachute if there's any times of trouble. There's something there to protect them. Might be a family network, a friendship network. Working class people tend to fall out with their families, as proved. and also, which is very important, is patrilineal sort of heritage in terms of like money is left to the children by the family, you know, and that happens over every generation, the family leave money, and that then provides a, you know, a position where that the adult children can then explore things because you've got financial security. Working class people haven't got financial security, you know.
That is true.
The key is for the working class, in whatever definition that is survival. where in terms of the middle class world, it's thriving. And so the thing is, the truth, particularly in this society, which is hierarchical, is working class people have to work 100 times more, harder, or that's it. You just got to work harder. Yeah. And or you're just going to end up, I mean, like, as I say, I taught on media production and there was a lot of working class kids, and that's it. They end up being runners, and that's meant to be a great goal. The great goal is to be, ooh, you might be a production assistant one day, but i.e. a gopher, you know. You're not going to be a decision maker. That's the thing. You know, who are the decision makers in the film and television? I mean, is there a film industry in the UK?
That's an excellent question, because I've spoken about that a lot, and sometimes I get a bit of heat for it. Like, people really don't like when I bring that up. I think it was Mike Lee?
Maybe.
Did he say that?
I don't know.
I'm thinking about that.
I think he said something along those lines, Mike Lee, because he's a strong sort of vocal component for stuff like that.
Yeah, he said that. I mean, what do you think, Jack?
Well, I've done things with the BFI, and I've done a sort of like gopher work for the BBC. So I've kind of met and been a sort of alien observer to a lot of these sort of like, basically in the circle, but also on the edge of the circle at the same time. And one of the main problems is, so they kind of give the illusion of offering support there and saying like, well, if you go through these channels, then you will, you know, be able to get a film. So you have like, you know, the BFI funds that go out for first time directors. But when you actually do your read and you actually do like delve a bit deeper into these, what they classify as first time isn't actually what is first time. Mm. So for a lot of like directors, when you're trying to apply for this funding, you already need to have a track record in place. And that's not necessarily just like, oh, well, I've already done like 3-4 films myself. That's an approved track record. So that's like things that have been on broadcast, things that have been in their list of approved festivals.
Yeah.
So that's... if you're a working class lad, and you know, it doesn't. And what they're doing there is, in a sense, they're also disregarding work that they've not approved of for you to then go get further funding. So they force you into a hole, really, where you end up just continuing to do it yourself, or you get really cynical and give up,
or you end up doing working on projects that are to a prescribed agenda, which is prescribed by these organisations. And so what you'll have is working class people working on middle class productions. And then you've got your metaphor for society right there. because you say, well, it's the only way I'm, you know, I don't know. It all depends. I mean, it depends why people go into film and media, or media in this country. It's like, in terms of making money. I mean, there was like lectures I worked in that worked on Deal or No Deal. Yeah, he was a production assistant on Deal or No Deal. Yeah. And he just went up and he said, you're just treated like a slave, and it's only the above the line people that make any money. Do you know what I mean? It's just like, and you're there going up and saying, right, and you get shouted at all the time and, you know, humiliated because there's time issues and standard issues, I suppose, that are happening in real time because nothing's ever planned out really properly. And you're there saying, well, I could earn the same money doing a job that's much calmer, you know?
Yeah.
And then that's it. And then what you see, if you go to any film or media department in any university or even maybe some colleges, and that's it. They're veterans. They're wounded from the industry, and they've gone, yeah, I've gone into education because to take a breather, to sort of feel human, a bit more human, I suppose, you know?
Yeah, completely. I think it's...
Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead. No, go ahead.
I'm just saying they don't... It's not a lifetime career, you know? It's sort of like, you know, it's super intense, and I'm sure you know better in London. You know, I mean, because like me, okay, things have changed a bit because Media City up here, the BBC had to move up here and stuff. They didn't want to, but they did. And in terms of certain departments. And then, but, you know, obviously intensity, and obviously what's known as the intensity of competition for places and stuff. And this is where you get people doing 18-hour shifts, you know, for little, very, you know. I'm sure you know better than me, actually.
No, I agree completely. And it's been quite a while since I've even done anything in regards, I say quite a while, 2018. I've done anything in terms of thinking about working for any kind of British establishment. You know, many of the things Jack said, I remember. I didn't realize it was that bad when they would say an approved list of broadcasts.
Yeah, well, it is the same with film festivals, though. It is the same. Because we had BIFA get in contact with us. And I've said, I mean, because you go up and say, what's the origin? Why would you make a film? And obviously you watch films as a kid and went, wow, these are amazing.
Yeah.
These are like controlled daydreams or controlled nightmares.
Yeah, yeah.
This is the business. So it's all about creativity. I want to do that. And then you'll, you know, whatever, play with toys and come up with scenarios or whatever in your bedroom or whatever. Anyway, and then you go and say, oh, I want to work in the film industry. And then it's the complete opposite of that. It's nothing to do with creativity. It's to do with regimented workload. And it's not your workload, it's somebody else's workload. And that was always been my approach to film. I'm saying you definitely do it for the love of creativity, you know, and that's why, in the case of this film, we had nothing to do with any organisation on purpose, because they'll just interfere with it and spoil it and take the sense. And then you're living and dying by your own standards, you know, and if you fail, you know, you fail according to your standards, you know what I mean? And then you correct it. You go, right, we need to do that again. And it is wonderful, because this is the most important thing. It's not money, it's life experience, you know?
Yep.
So you could, and I would recommend, I mean, make a film and see what you learn. Oh, yeah. You learn, even however clever or experienced you think you are. I was like 45 when we started shooting this, and I'm there going, I've learned loads. And I'm thinking, all right. I thought it was clever. All right, I'm pretty dumb.
it's always the case. Whether it's a short feature or whatever, anytime you've finished directing a film or something, you just learn so much about the process. And in good and bad ways, you learn a lot about yourself, in my opinion.
Yes. And this is what it is. It's about life. It should be like that in anything you do. I mean, the priority should be on that. It should be going, all right, is it on DVD yet? That's not the goal. that's silly. That's just silly. You got to go, how do you feel as a person after that? That's a proper question, you know, and that's like going, oh, right, you know, because, anyway, sorry.
No, it's fine. I mean, I get to speak every week on this podcast, so go ahead.
All right. No, but like, well, there you go, Jack, in terms of his sort of journey, because the thing is like when he first started and came on set, he was wondering why I was shouting about the angle of a mug when we were filming, when that mug needs to be moved just that way. Yeah. And so Jack was like, well, you're insane. And I'm like, I'm not insane. You've got to move the mug just there. And then later when you see the edit, you go, oh, I see now. This is why you're insane. It's so it catches the light perfectly and we can see it, but it doesn't look too obvious. And I go, yeah. Right. So obviously, there's a learning curve for everybody. You can't be self-centered. That's another good thing about filmmaking. It has to be most of the time a communal thing. Yeah. And everybody's learning. You know, everybody's going through their little journey as well. So, you know, you can't.
And as well, everybody needs to be on the same page in a way that I think may be unique to other kind of job situations, because you can get one or two who see the film in a completely different way than the director or the other crew members or whatever.
And tell me about it. Yeah.
Feel the pain and suffering for this film when people are not coming together in appropriate ways.
Oh, yeah. It's a great story, actually. I've read this book called something like 21 Stories by Independent Filmmakers. I'll tell it really quick. And it was in New York, and then this independent director, and they'd spent real money to get this New York apartment. This was in the 80s, and it was filming on 16mm. And they got this cinematographer, and they were filming it. And they filmed the scene, and then the director saw the rushes about 2 days later, and they were all out of focus. And they spent something like $16,000 on this. And he went, oh, my God, what's happened? And he contacted the cinematographer, and the cinematographer said, oh, no, I purposely shot it out of focus because I should be directing this film, not you.
What?
And that was, I read that story like in the late 90s when I was reading this book, and I went, ooh, are people like that? And then and I was sitting there going, right, and this is why. This is yeah, you've got to, people you're gonna work with, you've got to vet them, unfortunately. It depends what your position is, but you've got to vet them. And at the end of the day, I wouldn't say that people are on the same page. They've got to be on the same book or in a library, let's say. When it's the same page, they're gonna go, have you been to a library? And so I mean, because like we did a music video, Louis Bravis, it was called Mother anyway. And then it was all finished, got released, and did well for a music video. And then this guy, who was a runner, started putting on his CV and sharing it that he'd edited the video. Yeah, because he just wanted to raise his status to make out he wasn't just the runner. And then when people got in contact with me going, hey, you know that guy? The one who kept on poking his nose in and, like, you know, and he wasn't asked to. Do you know what I mean? And like, and yeah. Yeah, he started putting down, he edited the old video. And I went, well, I never, really.
But you yeah. it seems like you've got a good group. You must have a good group of people to have completed this successful indie film. And earlier, Jack mentioned that it's a zero budget, no budget. Oh, sorry, may have said that to me when we were messaging. When you say no budget, that can be quite vague, because
there
are things that are going to be of value in terms of finance that you used or you were able to use. And there's the travel expenses and food as well that are incorporated in independent films. How did you get through doing all of that and producing the film that you did?
I was living off my redundant. This is important. People never see this as part of the filmmaking process. I needed a room of my own, like Virginia Woolf. I needed a room of my own to write the script and also then do the storyboarding using a CAD. But I used Google SketchUp. And, you know, and then you rewrite the script based on the visuals. You see what I mean? Before you actually interact with anybody, you know? And then, but you need to have electricity, a roof over your head. You need to have a computer and that, all that's, and you need to eat and sleep and et cetera. And you need money. You need money to do that. And the thing is, I know this is going to be, it's not, you know, there's not going to be no money. No one's going to invest in this film. This film is about the horror of being human. And I'm going, no one's going to invest in this, because I don't think it'll sell any T-shirts, but I might be wrong. Anyway, but the thing is, and I'm there going to maintain this intensity of this narrative and characterization, I've got to just concentrate on this. And so I spent my redundancy money and didn't get a job. I just spent it writing the script. And then when that ran out, I took out a bank loan. I mean, like the old school, you know, I came of age in the 90s, so that was normal to me. But you get a bank loan and credit cards and overdrafts. And I just, and they're saying, I've got to get the script complete and the storyboard, you know. So this is a realistic creative project, not just a creative thing going, hey, check this out. You know, you're going to go, right, this is all the battle plans, the blueprints for a feature film, you know? And that takes time, and you need that. So that's where a lot money went into, you know what I mean, to create an attractive creative project, you know, and then which you can then pass on to crew members and then pass on to cast, you know, because they go, oh, this is really well written, this is really deep, you see what I mean?
Yeah.
And so that those costs, that the only cost that I've spoken about when it comes to shooting, you know, everybody says, oh yeah, and you go, no, there's loads of stuff in development and pre-production, there's loads of costs there, but, and this is where you've got to have good people then, because obviously everyone knew how much I'd sacrificed personally for, you know, the film, the thing, then everyone just helped out in terms of travel and food, and do you know what I mean?
Yeah, definitely know what you mean.
And so it was a bit of a sort of community thing. I mean, we had our core is only three members. It's me and Jack. I mean, Jack, he joined up sort of like 2.5 years or 3 years after me and Gwyn had been working together, you know, on the film and stuff. Jack came at a key moment because he was 20 then. But then he brought, there you go, superhuman energy and ambition that I've lost and with age. And so, and that was it. You needed that energy injection. of like going this, and to remind you what a very special thing it is to make a feature film. Yeah. And, you know, because you can get casual about it when you're doing it and going, oh yeah, and then that's very sad, and that means you know and then you need that's when you do need other people to come in going, this is amazing, what's going on here, is it, yeah, oh yeah it was 2 years ago, all right, yeah, I re-remember. But and also it depends, this is for filmmakers, where you're making a film. We didn't make this film in Doncaster. I'm not picking on Doncaster. I used to live in Derby. Yeah, I'll pick on Derby. So Derby, there's nothing happening. Do you know what I mean? There was nothing happening. But then in Manchester's got a great history, and obviously it's got a TV, you know, media industry and stuff. And so it's not completely alien to say it's pretty alien, but not totally alien to make a feature film. You know, it's in the environment. But if you're in the middle of nowhere, that can be difficult because people won't believe you.
Mm. Yeah, that's fair. That's understandable. I've been in places where it's considered the middle of nowhere, and I've seen how difficult it can be. But it seems to be a togetherness between a smaller crew that I might not have seen in London before, where it's more, I wouldn't say cutthroat, that's a bit extreme, but it's more kind of in and out. That's how I kind of felt. The woman, the director, her mum made the pies and stuff for us to eat. You know, it was kind of really small and friendly in that way.
But yeah, human experience, though. That's human togetherness, and these things matter. Yeah, you know, it's like, you know. Anyway, sorry.
But my last question, guys, before we go, like your film, you know, it concentrates on certain things that have been happening since Thatcherism and things like that, in terms of, touched upon class. Why do you think there isn't many films like yours being made in England? Because there's so much that's going on right now. We've got strikes all over the place. We've got, people can't afford some of their basics, food, and there's housing costs and everything. But I don't see any true representation of that, even in short films.
Exactly. And that's why this is one of the reasons the film is getting the coverage is because it is questioning the status quo. And also pointing out the obvious, which you've just listed right there. You go and go, right, what is happening to this country? And everyone's starting to go, wait a minute, we've been ripped off by loads of crooked politicians and billionaires. Is that what's happening here? You know?
Yeah.
And you go, right, well, there should be media. It's a closed shop. Who owns these media companies? They've got a vested interest. They're not going to question the money they're making, are they? And so I've always said, I was like, this is like we are in a domestic violence situation and we're going to send a film out to the neighbours, which is France or America or, you know, Brazil, and say, you'll never guess what's happening in the UK, you know. Oh, I thought it was all great there. You've got a royal family. You're all happy. But no, they're beating us up. Quick, call the police. That's what the film is. It's an emergency call. It's a hand grenade. We go, quick, get the authorities. And then we got a review in yesterday from Germany that went, it's happening here in Germany. There's no film saying about me.
Wow.
No, they're going to say, what did he say? He says, I'm jealous.
He wishes there was a film like this in German. But yeah, the film itself, with its messages and the way it's been presented, can still relate to him and others.
That was it. So there you go. So the thing is, this is why people watch the film and go, right, this is actually a bit true to life and very uncomfortable. Because if you tell somebody they're in an abusive relationship, they won't believe you to start with. Yeah. You have to, do you see what I mean? Now, I just think my opinion is we're in an abusive relationship with the powers that be. They're not out for our best interests.
Completely.
And I say nothing wrong with saying, if we do, you know, this illusion of a democracy we're meant to be in. And then just say, right then, well, and obviously I must mean it because we spent, well, there you go, 6.5 years doing the film. And then we spent another year promoting the film, you know, to say, right. And there we go. And which I've thought about. So this is what I'm saying about, if you're going to do a film, then do something that really matters. And it doesn't matter just to you, it matters to other people. And that's a lot of feedback we've got from abroad and from certain quarters at home. you've made a film that matters. This is going on right now, and you've done it as a film. And at the very least, it'll be a historical record. So in 10 years' time, people watching going, oh, my God, what was going on then? I'm going, we know.
Well, I take my hat off to you both and your entire crew and cast and everything, because I really, really was excited when I got the message from Jack about your project, because I thought, finally, I actually really feel like these people are people I can relate to. They're passionate filmmakers in this country. They've got the indie film spirit, and they're doing, making, sorry, a film that is for now. It's like these things have to be captured.
Yes.
You know? So I'm really happy for both of you to come on the podcast today.
If you like this podcast, share it with friends. Leave a comment in the comment section and hit the subscribe button. Have you thought of upgrading your cinematography game? Would you like to have an ASC cinematographer mentor you for free? Join veteran cinematographer Suki Medenzovic, ASC, Disney, Pixar, FX Networks, Netflix, American Horror Story. As he teaches you how to create beautiful images using three lighting techniques he has mastered on film sets over his 30-plus years in the film industry. Each technique uses basic, low-cost lighting equipment so that anyone can achieve beautiful visuals no matter your project's budget. If you want to take your cinematography to the next level, visit filmmakingconversations.com to sign up for instant access.
Now, if you like this conversation, this episode of the podcast, please do check out the show notes for so much more information about the film, Jack and Brett. Thank you for listening.